Washington puts off dealing with the debt again.
How long can this go on?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Monday, November 21st.
Coming up, the Super Committee might just want to change its name to the Committee because it hasn't been very super, Steve, at reaching a deal.
Spain becomes the latest European country to throw the bums out.
And why do we never learn that making your password 123456 7 is not a very smart idea?
It's not very smart at all. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Congressional Supercommittee is expected to announce today that it has failed to agree on $1.2 trillion in deficit savings over 10 years. And as Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, this is just the latest failure by Congress to deal with the nation's long-term debt problems.
The Supercommittee was born out of last summer's crisis over increasing the government's authority to borrow. Despite dozens of high-level meetings between the White House and congressional Republicans, the two sides could not find deficit reduction common ground. Before that, there was the Gang of Six, bipartisan senators who tried unsuccessfully to bridge the differences, and that gang was preceded by a presidentially appointed commission. It came up with a $4 trillion grand bargain that fell short of the required majority. Andy LePerrier with ISI Group says the two parties have very different views on the role of government.
Bottom line is that Democrats don't want to vote to reduce entitlement spending by a meaningful amount, and Republicans don't want to vote to raise taxes by a meaningful amount. So it's difficult to get either of them to get off of that position.
This latest attempt has a plan B, automatic across-the-board cuts in spending for both defense and domestic programs start January 2013, unless the next Congress and the next president decide to change them. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now let's talk to a member of the so-called Super Committee who's been in talks for the past few weeks trying to find these budget cuts to the tune of $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. Javier Becerra is a Democrat from California, and he's with us now. Congressman, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So are we going to see any kind of a deal today?
Well, if we're going to see one, it's going to have to be soon because time is about out.
Time is about out, but I mean, you know, you and 11 others know if a deal is coming. I mean, is it coming?
The elements of a deal have been on the table for quite some time. It's just whether or not we're willing to put the right balance to the plan so that we can all agree to move forward. And at this stage, what's become pretty evident is that some of these pledges, special interest pledges, are making it very difficult. When you have to have a balanced plan that includes some pretty aggressive spending savings and also includes some revenue to make sure that everyone, including the wealthiest Americans, contribute to getting the economy moving again, you have to see all of that. And right now, it seems like we're only seeing one or two aspects, but not all aspects of what would be a balanced plan.
I know the last time we spoke with you, Congressman, you said that not coming up with some sort of sweeping deal was not an option. And here we are with the possibility that that's going to happen. I mean, what do you say to your constituents and to people around the country who are like, hey, we really need something to get done?
I continue to say, hey, we really need to get something done. It doesn't change. And it would be I don't like to say it's a failure because I think we're always going to have opportunities to move forward. And the August compromise that was reached that created the super committee will provide $2.2 trillion worth of savings over the next 10 years. But it's better to do the savings the way we think is best versus having automatic triggers decide where the cuts will be made. And so this would be forsaking a great opportunity to have a human hand decide how to make some smart cuts and have smart savings for the country, and also include a jobs component, which the automatic triggers would not provide for, is job creation opportunities, which we desperately need to get 14 million people back to work. And by the way, when they're working, they're paying taxes.
Do you think, Congressman, this factors into the cynicism that some people have about politics in general, that you know, both sides are dug in and I'm not going to budge and you're not going to budge, and so nothing gets done in Washington. I mean, it's a complete polarization.
No, I think what people will find is when the dust clears, they'll be able to make assessments. Look, if you have a situation where some 1,400 multimillionaires in the last tax filing that we've seen, the 2009 tax filings, they show that they didn't pay a single cent in income taxes. These are multimillionaires. You know something's wrong. When Warren Buffett tells you that he's paying at a lower tax rate, effective tax rate, than is his secretary, you know something's wrong. And we know that the Bush tax breaks of 2001 and 2003, which benefited the very wealthy more than anyone else and have contributed more to these deficits than any other man-made policy, then you know you have to make sure that revenues are part of this total solution, whether it's a smaller deal of $1.2 trillion or a big deal the way some of us would have liked that, $4 trillion. But you can't have an unbalanced approach where you put the benefit of balancing the budget on the backs of seniors and middle class and believe that that's going to get us back on track.
I mean, is it the fact that they didn't give you enough revenue increases that this plan won't move forward?
I'd say that it's a matter of having a balanced deal. Balance could have been defined differently. I think Democrats were willing to make concessions to get what would still be defined as a balanced deal, but you have to have participation by everyone. Middle-class Americans are suffering. A lot of folks are figuring out how to pay for the mortgage or hold on to the job. Very wealthy Americans continue to get breaks when they fly on a corporate jet, when they take advantage of all the tax loopholes in the tax code. Everyone should participate. What that precise level should be, there was a lot of flexibility in getting there from a big plan to a smaller plan. I think Democrats were willing to put that on the table, as well as put on the table changes to very important programs for Americans that they've paid for, whether Social Security or Medicare, to try to really make this work on a bipartisan basis.
Should we ever expect, Congressman, to get a meaningful deficit reduction plan out of Washington?
Oh, absolutely. And this is where I think the American public has a right to be frustrated if we don't move forward in ways that are balanced, because for quite some time, the American people have been way ahead of the politicians in how to solve these problems. Poll after poll show how Americans would put everything on the table, make everyone sacrifice a little bit, and also make sure that we have a way to move forward. Most Americans will tell you that the best way to get this economy moving again is to put people back to work. And I think they're absolutely right. And so one way or the other, Washington will get the message from the rest of America that if not Wall Street, we should just worry about it. It's Main Street as well.
But they haven't gotten it yet.
I think more and more it's becoming clear that the public is far more united than are the politicians. And one way or the other, and again, the clock hasn't ticked completely off of the super committee, one way or the other, though, we'll get there, whether it's through the super committee or through the regular course through Congress. We should try to move this economy forward and put Americans back to work.
Javier Becerra, Congressman from California, thank you, sir, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, the fact that nothing has come out of the budget talks with only a few days left before the deadline, it's not surprising to Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan, who's with us now to talk about it. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's wrong with the bipartisan group of people who are supposed to work together to find budget cuts?
They were never going to work together to find budget cuts, and the reason is there turns out to be no downside from not finding them, at least not any real downside.
Not really downside, so no ramifications at all?
Well, in theory, in, I think, 2013, the government is supposed to reduce automatically defense spending by about 10% if nothing happens, and something is supposed to happen to social problems. But it's a long time between now and 2013, and you know perfectly well nothing will happen.
Don't these people, Alan, want to cut the budget and do something to secure the nation's, the credit rating that could be in jeopardy or whatever? I mean, just the nation's credit in general for future generations.
I assume that they want to do it, but they want to do it their way. And the Republicans have never seen any increase in government revenues that they like. And the Democrats are more compromising, but in the end are not going to sit there and cut the living stuff out of programs that they like. It's just not going to happen.
So you're saying the super committee was doomed from the very beginning.
All right. I am proud to say that in August, I wrote a rant that Fortune called American Idiots, and I called this plan a deficit-trimming deal so absurd you have to laugh when you think hard about it. So I never thought hard about it, and now I'm laughing.
And, does this mean, Alan, that we'll never have nice things because the Congress, and dare I say the nation, is so polarized that no one's just ever going to budge, not even to advance the greater good?
Well, sooner or later, something is going to happen if there's a crisis. And I hear that there's a rumor there's some election in 2012.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this?
I think I have.
And I think after that, things will resolve one way or the other. You and I may not like it, but at least it will give us something to talk about on the radio.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Let's get some analysis now from our regular Monday guest, Julia Coronado. She is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, how long can we continue to have Washington do nothing about the long-term debt in this country and still be okay?
Well, the problem is we just don't know the answer to that. I mean, right now, investors are perfectly willing to finance our deficits at low interest rates, in part because they're fleeing from Europe. But if Europe ever gets its act together, we may actually start to pay for our lack of fiscal discipline through higher interest rates.
Well, you mentioned Europe. Obviously, the latest news out of Europe is that Spain has become the third country to throw the bums out and get a new government. And do you think there are any lessons to be learned in Washington from this?
Well, the lesson that I hope that we learn is that we don't want to get that far down the road before we realize that we have to elect politicians who are willing to present us with the difficult choices that need to be made. Spain is dealing with an unemployment rate of 25% and paying interest rates north of 6% on their debt. So that's a very, very extreme situation. And the sooner we deal with these problems, the easier they are to solve.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. Spain has become the latest European country to get rid of its government. After Italy and Greece did, Spain held elections over the weekend, sent the ruling Socialist Party packing, and gave the conservative Popular Party control of parliament. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us now from Madrid with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what was the electorate in Spain saying here?
Well, the Popular Party campaigned purely on a platform of change, saying it was the party which represented a safe pair of hands for the Spanish economy, that could manage the Spanish economy better than the socialist government has managed to do in the past 8 years.
And when you say manage the economy, I assume you mean make big cuts, maybe raise taxes.
The Popular Party has spoken about austerity. It's spoken about sacrifices. It hasn't spoken about tax increases. In fact, it's talking about cutting tax for businesses, trying to promote entrepreneurialism. It's talking about trying to promote small and medium-sized businesses to get them hiring people again and try to tackle Spain's really big problem, which, of course, is unemployment. Almost 5 million people here in Spain unemployed.
And do the people in Spain this morning feel that they're going to get what they want?
I think half of Spain is hopeful and the other half of Spain is pretty gloomy. People on the left wing here in Spain are concerned about possible cuts to the welfare state. They're concerned about austerity measures affecting health and education. People on the right wing, I think, are pleased that finally their party has come to power and they hope that it can bring the change that it's promised. But it's a really tall order because, of course, all the eyes of the Eurozone and the international markets are also on Spain to see if the Popular Party can really deliver what it's promised.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Madrid. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to our own Stephen Beard, who is watching events in Spain and in Washington as well, as we mentioned, with the super committee presumed failure to find any sort of cuts or compromise in their talks. And Stephen joins us now from our European desk in London. Hey.
Hello, Steve.
Are Europeans really paying attention to all this super committee and its possible failure?
They certainly are. There is one more bit of bad news. The fear, of course, is that if there's further political gridlock in Washington, there'll be further downgrades of the US's credit rating. By the way, Steve, this does give the Europeans a small fleeting moment of grim satisfaction, because it was only last week that President Obama was chiding the Europeans for failing to get their debt crisis under control.
Grim satisfaction. All right, but the US debt problem isn't anywhere near Greece or Europe, right?
No, the Eurozone debt crisis is much worse and apparently deteriorating. As you said, we've just had a new government elected in Spain with a mandate to cut the deficit, and yet Spanish borrowing costs went up this morning. There's much more pressure on Europe than in the US. Here's Stephen Lewis, a bond expert with Monument Securities.
The US doesn't need to act as swiftly as the European authorities, because the consequences of failure for the US administration are not as dire as they probably will be for the Europeans.
After all, he says, there's the possibility that one or more Eurozone governments could go bust and that the euro itself could break up. No one seriously believes the US is going to default or that the dollar would disappear.
All right, Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Well, so far, the biggest direct impact of the European debt crisis on our financial system was the collapse of MF Global. Remember that, Steve?
Yeah.
MF Global, the
John Corzine-run
firm.
That's right.
Well, the company went bankrupt because of its large bets on European debt. Now, MF Global may not have been a household name before its downfall, but as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, it was a member of a very exclusive club at the Fed.
When the man behind the curtain at the Federal Reserve wants to get control of a wicked witch in the financial world, he enlists the help of others.
Ah, you liquidated her, eh? Very resourceful.
Yes, sir.
When the Fed needs help pouring money on the nasty economy, for example, it uses what are called primary dealers, firms that buy and sell massive amounts of government bonds to control the flow of money. David Weiss is a former chief economist for the Fed. He says literally saving the world, at least financially speaking, requires firms that are up to the task. And the Fed's website says it rigorously reviews those partners to make sure they are.
Obviously, they want to deal with people who are going to be around, not people that are going to disappear next week. So clearly they missed it on this one.
This one being the recent bankruptcy of MF Global, just 9 months after the Fed chose the firm as one of its primary dealers. The Fed's website cautions its list of special trading partners is not meant to be an endorsement. But its Stone and McCarthy Research Associates, Ray Stone, says it's pretty much viewed as one.
While the Fed isn't giving them a good housekeeping seal of approval, they are thought by their customers to be stronger and bigger and get better prices than the little dealers.
Those customers range from big money investors to retirement funds. The failure of MF Global is yet another blow to trust in the financial markets, and the Fed is now requiring its primary dealers to keep more rainy day cash on hand. Banking industry consultant Bert Ely says it figures.
That's not surprising. Usually after the house burns down, people start trying to figure out how do we prevent the next fire. So this is a typical after-the-fact response.
Ely expects a congressional inquiry into how MF Global was chosen and whether similar troubles might be lurking. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, now to Alabama. Steve, your former stomping grounds.
My former stomping grounds, yes.
Which recently passed this tough new immigration law that requires police officers to check a driver's immigration status on routine traffic stops. Mm-hmm. Well, last week, an officer did just that, pulled over a driver whose rental car was missing a license plate, and discovered that the driver of the car was German, only had a German photo ID.
Yeah.
So arrested him, took him down to the station, and then found out that the guy was an executive from Mercedes-Benz, which employs more than 4,000 people at a plant near Tuscaloosa,
Alabama. I know that plant very well in Vance, Alabama. Yeah.
Well, long story short, he was not deported.
He was not deported.
No. He remains – he was let go.
And in other news, Mercedes will now leave Alabama. No, it's not going to leave Alabama, but what an interesting story anyway on the heels of that law. Later today, computer hardware giant Hewlett-Packard will report its earnings. The company, as you might recall, fired its CEO a couple months back and hired former eBay chief and former California politician Meg Whitman. And it's now adding an unorthodox member to its board. And Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports the company's new strategy seems to be, if you can't beat them, well, let them join.
Activist investors are like any activists, outsiders. That's why analyst Brian Marshall of ISI Group says it was a surprise when HP announced activist shareholder Ralph Whitworth is taking a seat on its board.
I'm sure Ralph approached the board, said we can do it this way, we can do it that way.
Kind of like that line from the A-Team.
Now, we can do this the hard way or the easy way.
The board picked the easy way. The company's last three CEOs were fired or resigned in controversy.
Many of us who teach in corporate law use HP as sort of a case study of board dysfunction.
UC Berkeley law professor Eric Talley says when Whitworth agreed to take a board seat, he also agreed to a board requirement that he not push for a sale, spinoff, or merger.
By tying his hands with these restrictions, maybe you've sort of insulated yourself from that type of shareholder activism over the next 2, 3, or 4 years.
Which is just the kind of honeymoon the company could use with its new CEO, Meg Whitman. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, Tyson's Foods this morning said sales were up, but higher costs for things like chicken feed cut profit by more than half. It's the nation's biggest meat processor. Marketplace's Scott Tong says it's been a tough stretch for the poultry industry as food companies try to wing it.
Chicken producers aren't giving thanks this year. At least four went bankrupt. Blame it on poultry fundamentals. Costs of feed like corn are up. And in a soft economy, sales of the big moneymaker, boneless, skinless breast, are down. Economist David Harvey is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You know, when a lot of people are stressed economically, they're going to be moving down the buying chain, you know, and substituting less expensive products for more expensive products.
The price of white meat at the wholesale level has fallen 17% over last year. But there is hope. Early signs suggest prices are rising again as big chicken companies cut supply.
5, 6, 7% below the previous year. So we're definitely seeing less chicks being placed for grow out.
Oh, and if you're still shopping for Thursday, consider chicken. The Farm Bureau says everything else, pumpkin pie mix, sweet potatoes, turkeys, has gotten pricier. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally this morning, worried about how secure your password is on your computer, Jeremy? I know, you know, it's funny.
Sometimes I wonder, but then I think, who's going to figure it out?
Who's going to figure this stuff out? And you know, it's not just one password anymore. I mean, we all have, like, how many?
Yeah.
Probably
a number of them.
A dozen, two dozen.
And half of them, they make you redo it every now and again. So you sort of come up with these, a few in your head, and you just rotate.
I don't even know how we remember these words. Yeah. But anyway, there's a new list out that tells you what words to avoid. These are the words that you shouldn't use as your password. A computer application firm Splash Data put this list together, the 25 worst passwords of 2011. Obviously, it's going to be easy to figure out the password that's 1234567.
Yes.
Why do people do that? I don't understand that.
Easy to remember.
Yeah, well, I guess so. ABC123.
Yep.
I think QWERTY, QWERTY.
Just run your fingers right along the keyboard.
Exactly, your left hand. Sunshine and I Love You. Also made the list. Isn't that nice? Those are really sweet. Apparently hazardous for your computer. But the worst password to use that's got the most amount of holes, the biggest security problems with the word is password. People use the word password as their password.
You know, I feel like I've worked in places where that is the password
like
that
default.
They start you off with.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's really smart. Mm. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
All right, have a great Monday. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.